Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz. Biz is spelled B-I-Z. That's ogc@accessradio.biz. So who's today's guest? Well, he hails from Australia, but is now a URC minister in Birmingham, UK. Our guest is a Shalom activist and the author of 9 books. He runs Seedbeds, a global community committed to releasing the unique potential of local people and places across the world. Our guest believes that every local community has the potential to flourish. The key to unlocking that potential lies in local leaders and community builders. So, what is a Shalom activist? Why did he live in Bangkok's biggest slum for 12 years? How do you work alongside a movement who cannot work in their regular jobs because of their country's military dictatorship? What is a local enterprise incubator? And most importantly, why is he a baggie? All these questions deserve answers. Gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, Dr. Ash Barker. Ash, thank you so much for joining us today. And for those that don't know you, where are we speaking to you from, please?
I'm at Lodge Road Community Church in Winton Green, so in inner city Birmingham. Love it here, and not far from the Hawthorns, for those who, like me, love the baggies.
Which is the nickname for West Bromwich Albion. I have been to that ground so many times with my team. I've never, ever seen us win there. How big a supporter are you of the baggies?
I love it. I'll be there this Saturday. It's been pretty heartbreaking. We have been a bit of a yo-yo club, but we're now settling in the championship.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Yes, as is my team, but we're going up. You can come with us as well if you want.
Who do you support, Matt?
The Mighty Reds, Bristol City.
Oh, very good.
But before we go further into what you actually do, please, Ash, 5 important or not so important questions. So, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. Question 1, young Ash, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask some questions, who would it be?
It would be Tony Campolo.
Yes.
People may know he passed away yesterday as we're recording this. And he's been such a big influence in my life, from an 18-year-old to supporting us overseas. I met my wife 6 months after standing up at a Tony Campolo meeting, going anywhere for the cause of Christ. And she went to that same meeting. We didn't meet there, but we met 6 months later. She also was going anywhere for the cause of Christ. We fell madly in love. Got married as 20-year-olds.
Wow.
And the last 35 years, we've been trying to live that out. So I'm really missing Tony today. And we became good friends over the years. And I'm missing him today.
It was your good self who told me that he died yesterday. In the next few days or so, you and I and other people that I know and you know, we can get together and put a fitting tribute together about the man so we could put it out, if that's okay.
That would be wonderful, man. Love to do it.
And I can then share my stories about how he almost killed my wife. Amongst other things, and also the interview that's described as probably the greatest interview I ever did all those years ago on radio, but it wasn't allowed to be broadcast. So
wow.
We can talk about that as well.
I'd love to hear that interview.
No, I'd love to hear it. I never kept it, nor did my good friend who made at the time the correct decision.
Oh.
I remember it all up in my brain cells.
Yes.
A few that got left. Question 2, who was your favourite biblical character or your favourite biblical story? Or your favourite parable?
Well, I mean, Jesus is my favourite character. Is that cheating?
Well, a few people have said him before. I should maybe rephrase that question. Outside of Jesus in the New Testament, who is your favourite biblical character?
I love James and John, and I'm doing the Camino on Sunday.
Oh, are you?
And so I love the story of James, this kind of willingness to drop the nets and follow Jesus wherever. Yeah, so he's certainly one of my favourite stories. I mean, the parable of the sower is my latest book is about that. So I'm a little bit of a victim of my last book and my last kind of ideas. But yeah, the parable of the sower who willing to keep sowing and sowing, and eventually the harvest comes, is one of my favourites too.
This is a bit worrying, actually, because I don't know if we're related. You've already named Tony Campolo, who's up there with the best of them for me. You just mentioned James, who's like one of my favourite, especially in the book of James, and also the parable of the sower. I was like, whoa. I'm surprised you're not a Bristol City fan, really. Then I really would be asking questions. Good answer. Thank you. Question 3. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose new law, what would it be, please, young sir?
It would be around housing. if you don't have secure homes, so I give free homes for everybody that are simple, basic, affordable. If you've got a house, you can build a life. But if you don't have one, if you're in secure housing, and we probably know that the UK are about 1 million homes short of what's required. So many people are in housing insecurity. And our neighbourhood here in inner city Birmingham is really struggling because of insecure housing. So, yeah, I would sort that out.
Great answer. Good luck with that. I don't know how many decades you'll need to do it, but it's a great answer.
Yeah, and there are so many vested interests, including those in Parliament who have their own, have numerous homes themselves and wouldn't want that investment to be lost. So, yeah, it would take a bit.
Actually, I don't know if you remember, before he came over here, a footballer called Lou Macari.
Yeah, he played for Man United.
He did. He did, and also managed Swindon Town, amongst other teams, and, of course, Stoke City. And what he has done in Stoke is incredible. He was able to take over basically a big warehouse because he realised there were people on the streets who couldn't get anything, couldn't get a bank account because they had no permanent address.
Yes.
And he put these little pods inside the warehouse.
Wow.
So that people could have a legitimate pod because there'd be an address.
Yeah.
Amazing what he's done there.
He's got a good fish and chip shop as well, isn't he, Lou Macari?
Has he?
Yeah. It's just near Old Trafford, yeah.
Wow. Didn't know that either. Well, we'll have to try that one. Next season when we're in the Premier League. Or maybe when Man United come down into the Championship. One of the two.
That can happen.
It can. I've seen it before. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out, please, Ash?
My favourite place to go for a day out is Holy Island of Lindisfarne. We do lots of pilgrimages, and my favourite day out is when we walk barefoot across the Pilgrim's Post on low tide to this very sacred island. I've done it, I don't know, not 100 times, but a lot of times, dozens of times, and every time it's different, and it's one of my very favourite places to go.
Great answer, thank you. Why is it so special then, Lindisfarne?
It's a good question. I mean, the Celts talk about thin places where it feels like heaven and earth are about to touch. And I do feel like there's something in the atmosphere where people have prayed for so long. I think the Celtic kind of imagination is there as well. You have this kind of enchanted worldview, and it can spook you a bit too. One of the first times I did it, I hear this, kind of say, oh, the ghosts are coming. Well, old Celtic saints are scaring me. It was the seals. So I can get carried away with my kind of enchanted imagination, but it's really easy to feel it. I like the word shalom, God, people and place living in harmony together, and that sacredness of the place just somehow connects with us. And when we come back to Winston Green, I feel like I can notice it more.
I've even heard there's a pub on the island as well. It's supposed to be quite good.
There's lots of pubs. Yeah, there's three of them, and we have tested them all out. They're all quite good.
That's what I like to hear. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment then, please, Ash?
Probably a school day. The shame as a teenager is always a bit hard. I went to a really rough government school, and we used to have these linen school bags, and they had little pockets, but there was little ropes that would kind of tie them up. And one of the bullies kind of got me before I got on my bike to ride home and lit one of the strings holding the pockets in. I saw it and I stamped it out, a bit annoyed, but put it back on my backpack and started riding home about 20 minutes. As I'm going past, the cars beeping and people waving at me, and so I'm waving kind of back. And it wasn't until I got just about home is that I realised my backpack was on fire. Everything was burnt in it. My lunchbox was melted and all my homework was burnt. But yeah, that's probably an embarrassing moment.
Well, I've got to ask then, if all your homework was burnt, what did you say to the teacher the following day, and did he believe you?
He did believe me, but I did bring all the charred remains to show him.
And then he believed you?
Yes. He wasn't sure if I'd done it myself to avoid it, but anyway.
Did you grass on the person that did it? That was the thing.
No, I would not dare at my school, mate. Very dangerous.
Yeah, it turns out that bully, if you're listening, is now most probably one of the most sacred people in the whole of Australia. Loved by millions.
Either that or in prison, I'm not sure.
Well, if you are listening, sir, please email us and let us know what actually happened from your point of view and how remorseful you were. That'd be good. I wonder, did that actually help you in any way to a future career, the fact your backpack was burnt?
Probably not. The school I went to was certainly a huge challenge, and to survive it, there was no chance to graduate at my school. And it did shape and gave me a lot of sympathy for people in normal working kind of situations. So yeah, it did shape you in a funny kind of way, but yeah, maybe not that particular instance.
I'm going to start it here. We hear that expression every so often. Oh, that bloke, he really is on fire for God. Well, in this case, I can say it started with you, Ash. And what a great name, Ash as well.
Ash is on fire. It's funny, in England, I often call myself Ashley Barker to try and be understood. In Australia, it's Ash Barker. But I lived in Bangkok, and there's no SH sound, and the G and the K can sound similar. So they were calling me Ashley Bugger. Actually, they call me Lee in Thailand now.
Oh, that is brilliant. Can I keep that in? Because that is so funny.
Well, more than welcome, mate.
Thank you. Where are we going to go from here? You're a shalom activist. What does that mean, please, Ash?
I love the word shalom. I've just published a book called No Wastelands, How to Grow Seedbeds of Shalom in Your Neighborhood. A friend of mine did the audio version of it. I did the speaking, and he said, I've used the word shalom over 500 times in the book. He was getting sick of it. It is one of my favorite words. It literally means, well, it's often translated peace in English, but it's a Hebrew word, and it really means God, people, and place living in harmony together. And for me, it's the image of what the kingdom of God does when heaven touches earth. It's a promise, it's a power, and I just find it a much more helpful word to use to describe what I'm about. I get to explain it. If I describe myself as a tele-evangelist, people might run away. Shalom activist has an intrigue to it that helps me engage with all kinds of people. I love my neighborhood. So the literal place I live in is Winston Green. I've had three relocations really. So one into Springvale in Melbourne, very multicultural, multiracial, multireligious neighborhood in Melbourne, where I'm from. And then 12 years in Bangkok in a slum community called Klong Toi, some of 100,000 people in a square mile. And then here in Winston Green. And all three of them, it wasn't just the people. The people were important, but it was the physicality of what God was doing in those places that was being healed and made whole and renewed. And I'm interested in those three dimensions, God, people, and place living in harmony together. So I love the word shalom.
So from the beaches of Melbourne, what did you say, Melbourne over there?
Melbourne.
From the beaches of Melbourne then to the beaches of Birmingham. Doesn't quite sound right. How did you end up in Birmingham?
My dad's English. Actually, I say I'm a Baggy supporter, but I grew up as a Man United supporter. My dad's not far from Manchester. So hence the Lou Macari and all those kind of people like Gordon Buchan and all these kind of...
Yeah.
Steve Coppell, Brian Robson, all these kind of players who I love. I always joke, my dad was a carpenter. My mother's name was Mary. They wouldn't have a Messiah complex. Dad was from Manchester Carpenter. He met Mum, who was from Scotland, and they met out in Melbourne. My mum loved the Beatles, and the Beatles came out in 1964 to Melbourne. You might have seen some of the black and white kind of concerts, and my mum's there screaming her head off. They do a big close-up of her. And so when she met my dad, she said, oh, you sound like one of the Beatles. Say love me do. And so he put on a Liverpool accent. He was from Manchester. Put on a Liverpool accent, said, love me do. And so they fell madly in love. And so I always say, if it wasn't for the Beatles, I wouldn't be here. So what was the question again? Sorry, mate, I'm going off on a tangent.
I'm just thinking, how many people are going to say, well, never mind the question, who are the Beatles? It's like, what? How did you end up in Birmingham?
Yeah, so I came to visit Birmingham as a boy and visit all the relatives. Mum and Dad hadn't been back to the UK. So this is 1977. I really loved Birmingham. We had kind of friends, family friends here, and we spent a couple of weeks here. And for some reason, I thought I'd always come back here. It kind of got lost in translation, really, of my life kind of took over. And then about 2012, Andy Flanagan, a friend of ours, invited us over with Tear Fund to come and speak. It was the first time I'd been back since 1977.
Wow.
I just loved it here. I do love English football as well, and seeing Manchester United play at Old Trafford. And I literally was at Fergie's last game at Old Trafford, which was kind of amazing. I'm actually on the back of his autobiography as he's going down the tunnel for the last time at Old Trafford.
Wow.
I loved all that. But we were really happy in Bangkok. I'd run Urban Neighbours of Hope for over 20 years, a kind of community of activists and mission workers. And this is 2012. Wasn't thinking anything more other than I really liked it here. We were invited to start an Urban Neighbours of Hope team. So we had teams in Melbourne and Sydney and Wellington and Auckland and Bangkok and on the refugee camps on the Thai Burma border. And so we said, well, what about here in England? And we were in Birmingham, I'm the Church of Christ minister. And so they said, you know, what about over here? So I got some friends from Melbourne who were part of the team there. It was a bit intimidating, I'm honest. We went to one of those kind of really grim kind of housing estates.
Mm.
One of the team in Melbourne was from a Sri Lankan background. And so she really kind of felt really intimidated.
Yeah.
Felt it was kind of too much. I, on the other hand, just loved it. I thought, wow, what a vibrant kind of place. There's so much potential and so central to everything. Bangkok was feeling quite, it's a massive city, but quite isolating as well. I just finished my PhD. And so it was a really interesting year, 2012. It also felt like we're needing to let go of the organization we'd started and let the next generation kind of go in a different direction that they wanted to go rather than just keep doing it the way we had been doing it. And so by the following year, actually, there was a discernment kind of process. Do we need to let go? Do we need to move out? I also got really sick in 2013, dengue fever, typhoid, typhus, a number of these kind of tropical diseases and nearly died. And my body just didn't respond again. I just couldn't recover. And so it was about letting go. And then it was, well, what do we do next? If we're not urban neighbours of hope, if we're not in Bangkok. And I said, oh, look, I've always loved England. And I had this kind of feeling, you know, if I had another life, Birmingham would be the place I'd want to spend it. I wonder if we should explore that. We talked to the Churches of Christ over here. And I said, look, if it wasn't urban neighbours of hope, it was just coming over, would you like that? Would you be up for that? There's a role for us here. The Theological College said we'd love a centre for urban ministry. Steve Chalk, some of your listeners may know, visited us in Bangkok around this time as well. And he said, look, if you're interested in Birmingham, I know the place you should go. It's Winston Green. All the things, and you're doing in social enterprise and community development, you could do that at Winston Green. And we're going to be taking over a failing government school. You could be based in that school, get to know everybody. It's on a street that will become quite famous in 2014. A documentary series is being made about it called Benefit Street. You'll be right in the epicenter of all that. And so, yeah, so it did feel like actually the same as Springvale and Klong Toei. These places kind of chose us more than we chose them. Now, none of our plans survived impact in lots of ways, and we've had to start everything again. But those invitations and that opening and that sense of we were home, this is where we're supposed to be, has been really important. I always kind of joke, there's always the ideal of what it's going to be like, then there's the ordeal, and then if you hang around, sometimes you get the new deal. And that's been true for us here in Winston Green.
Thank you for sharing that. What comes out straight away, you were prepared to let things go, because when you look back at history and people that start something off, even though they say, oh, look, we've retired or whatever, they still have to have their fingers in it and still control it. You were able to make a complete break.
Yeah.
How involved were you actually in making that complete break? And what was it really like at the time?
Well, it was very difficult. And I mean, really the younger group, and we'd had a group, really a leadership team that had been together for a long time. And we were all activists. We were wanting to see things happen in our neighborhoods. And so there was a feeling that, yeah, the direction they wanted to go was different to the one I wanted. So you've kind of got some choices then. Do you kind of force your way and push these brilliant people out?
Yeah.
Or do you compromise it, or do you let go? And I really felt to let go in the end. I'd push as far as I could, but I think had I pushed harder, I would have bent everybody out of shape. And so it was a genuine letting go. There was a kind of a you know, transition process. It was June 2014. Yeah, June 2014 is when we kind of had our farewell and we let go of everything. We were in Australia for a little bit. My mum and dad are there. My daughter's there. I did a little bit of kind of transition work and then we moved in November 2014. And look, being in a different continent, in another part of the world, part of not going to Australia was they're not trying to mess things up for others. And my profile in some people's minds is there. For other people, you know, not so much, and they would never, people, you know, forget about you after a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But it felt important to give everyone a good chance to do it without us. Now, Urban Neighbours of Hope didn't grow and develop the way we would have liked. And actually, just last month, the last Urban Neighbours of Hope team in Australia stopped. And the work in New Zealand continues, in Auckland and Wellington, and the work in Bangkok does. Yeah, it's fair to say it's not the dynamic organisation it was in its heyday. And so there's a bit of sadness about that. You go and you can't be responsible for what other people do. You just hope the DNA of what you've left behind can work. And so, but what I get to do now, I couldn't do were I trying to be in charge and try and hold on in control? And so letting go is part of the journey.
See, that's really interesting. And thanks for sharing on this, because one of the themes that seems to be running through the past 20 or 30 episodes of Off-Grid Christianity is this feeling of, well, maybe I just need to do something new, or I feel God's telling me to do this, but, and normally the but means I'm worried about the future and finances. Now, you and I can most probably wax lyrical on what it's like to go through that. In particular, your good self, though, I mean, I only had to move about 150 miles, whereas you've had to move 150 miles, oh, and then fly over quite a few continents as well to get to Winston Green. You were prepared to trust an organization to say, come over to Winston Green. What was it like for you, especially after what you've been through previously setting up a major, major organization?
Yeah, so it didn't work is what happened. We'd raised the money for the first year, and basically the theological college changed their mind. But once they got
what?
And decided they didn't really want an urban ministry center in Winston Green. And so I hung it out for a year trying to make it work. Yeah, so I had to let go of that partnership and the money that was there. And I got a job as a chaplain in the local prison here. But I still felt really cool and had to go back to donors in Australia to apologize that it hasn't worked out. But I still felt called to Winston Green. So did Ange. Ange kind of kept going with Oasis. It was hard for Ange to be based in a primary school. We didn't quite realize how difficult that would be. Where we live, one of my favorite mission theologians is Leslie Newbegin. He would have been the other person I would have loved to have had dinner with. I've never met him, but his writings were really influential in the 90s. You couldn't go through theological training in Australia without reading Leslie Newbegin. And he actually wrote some of these best material here in Winston Green. Gospel of Plural Society, Foolishness to the Greeks, Open Secret. He wrote them here. And so when we were able to take over an old vicarage that hadn't been used, we relaunched it as Newbegin House. And John Newbegin, Leslie's son, came, and the Bishop Birmingham came. John Newbegin was terrific. He said, oh, look, my dad didn't really want to come to Winston Green. He was retired. He'd finished at a theological college, but they were going to close down this church. And he said, well, I'll go if no one else will. The church can't withdraw from the inner city. I'll go if I need to. And they said, okay, then. And so he came. And it was his most fruitful writing period and reflection on mission in the West and having confidence in the gospel and all that kind of stuff he wrote here. So we started again, essentially what happened, with Newbegin Community Trust based from Newbegin House. And we started Newbegin School for Urban Leadership, which has now become Seedbeds. So once we started again, and both of us kind of working regular jobs in a way, and then slowly cutting those jobs down to eventually we could be full-time in those two organizations. Those first 2 years were difficult. We got into debt. We felt like we'd let donors down. And it was a really dark, dark time of our lives. Ange didn't really want to leave Bangkok. She loved it there. She was a fish in water. And so, yeah, what have you done? You're taking me to this cold, dark place. And I, of course, loved it because I'd nearly died in Bangkok from the heat and everything, tropical diseases. And I weren't going to get bitten by rats or anything here. So, yeah, so I loved it. Celts talk about a resurrection place. You know, they would go off in those little coracles and the place they thought that they would die. But when Jesus comes back, they'll rise again in that place. And I kind of have that feeling for here, for Winston Green. I absolutely love it here. This could well be my resurrection place. Ange didn't feel like that. So it was really stressful at that time. But over time, yeah, Ange found her mojo with Newbegin Trust. She grew that to be, you know, 4 local hubs in the community. We have a really asset-based approach. So working with what's strong, you know, discovering that talents and gifts and bringing people together and releasing them in there. Gifts and talents is kind of what we do, what we've been doing all most of our lives. And so Ange got to really do that with Newbegin Community Trust. And she's just literally just handed it over this year to a local team. She's actually on the Thai Burma border at the moment, working with our Seedbeds team there. But no, it was dark, but we kind of all needed to die for the new thing to rise up. And so I'm really grateful that I get to do what I get to do now. But I didn't feel like that at the time.
There's another thread that's been at the back of every single podcast, I think, as well. Maybe not at the forefront, but certainly from my point of view and from quite a few guests as well. And that is the expression, die to self. And you've just more or less made that statement there, to die to self. I'd love to hear your take on what you think die to self actually means, therefore.
Yeah, I think a lot of Christianity is a consumer, you know, how do I get things from God? And you see that in its most extreme in some of the kind of prosperity kind of, you know, if you just tithe enough, give enough, pray enough, God will give you what you want. That's not Christian faith to me. Christian faith is about surrender, surrendering all to God so God can do through us what God wants done in the world. And so that willingness to be a channel for God's compassion and grace and love and to let go of control, let go of security, that's all part of the journey of discipleship and following Jesus to me. But it is a lot easier said than done. And honestly, it was easier to do that when you were a 20-year-old moving into Springvale than a 45-year-old moving to Birmingham, that's for sure.
Not that we've ever talked about Tony Campolo, but one of his great expressions that I then had to write down, and I suppose it's something that I've been trying to work on ever since, he made a disparaging remark about a certain chorus we used to sing in those days, which is, I surrender all.
Yes, I surrender one-tenth.
Yes, it. It's true, isn't it? Now, maybe I've got the wrong end of the stick on that. What do you think he meant by that?
I think a lot of Christians think if they just do their little bit, they can give their 10% and keep the 90%. I think God wants us to use everything we have and everything in our hands. And sometimes it doesn't feel like a lot. One of my other favorite gospel stories is the bread and the fish, the feeding the 5,000 stories. I love those stories because Jesus has compassion for the crowds. The disciples don't have any power. And Jesus says, well, what do you have? And they say, well, we've got a little bit of bread and a little bit of fish. And you feed them. And he says, well, this is all we've got. But in the hands of Jesus, what we've got is enough, and it feeds the multitudes. And I do feel like when we, whatever talent or gifts or when we give it to God, it goes much further than if we try and control it ourselves. And it's amazing what God can do with our bread and fish.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. Well, you mentioned that your wife is currently in Thailand on the border. Before we get to what you do within a certain country that might be or might not be a military dictatorship, you lived in Bangkok's biggest slum for 12 years. I know you've mentioned rats and things like that. Why did you love it so much?
I think it was the challenge. There was that sense that, that Jesus was calling us there, that we felt at home there. One of my favorite quotes is from Lao Tzu, go to the people, live with them, learn from them, love them. Start with what they know, build with what they have. But with the best leaders, when the work is done, the task accomplished, the people will say, we've done it ourselves. I'd want to add with the help of the Lord. But we could see how we could do that in Klong Toei. You can't look at a place like Klong Toei and say, we're going to do a needs analysis and we're going to find out what's wrong with this community and we're going to fix it up. You can't do that. You can only work by discovering what the gifts and talents are. It was such a joy to do it. I mean, just very quickly, one of my neighbors, her name was Pooh, P-O-O. She was a brilliant cook and she'd cook out the front of her house. We lived in a house about the size of four double beds, and so we didn't have a kitchen, so we couldn't really cook ourselves, and everyone in the neighborhood was like that. But we'd always go to Pooh, and for less than a pound, you can get this great pile of food that she would cook that was delicious and amazing. But one day the price of rice went through the roof, and the subsidies the government had on rice suddenly left, and people's wages didn't go up, and so Pooh couldn't cook and sell her food at a price that people could afford. And so she just kept the prices low, hoping that things would change. They didn't, and she got into debt. And when you get into debt into a place like Klong Toei, you get into debt to some really dangerous underworld kind of figures. And she was really scared for it. She had two boys and husband and really scared for them all. So she was in tears, really, talking to Anne. She said, what could I do? And it wasn't that big a debt. It was like 100 quid or something. We had that in the bank. We could have kind of solved the problem. The problem is, though, if you start solving Pooh's problem, you can't do it. And also there was something that would put Pooh into our debt, and that would be really complicated, and it would mess up the relationship a lot as well. And just really good at detecting joy, detecting people's strengths and gifts, and said to her, look, you're such a great cook. Why don't you teach people how to cook? Lots of our Australian friends come over. They spend a fortune on Thai cooking schools. Maybe you should try that, and I'm happy to work with you to do it. And she was a bit nervous about it. Eventually, we had some Aussie friends that came over and said, well, why don't we try it out with these guys? They're really up for it. She took them to the local market. The market in Bangkok, I don't know if you've been to Bangkok, but the markets are wild. I mean, there's cockroaches that they deep fry and you can eat them, and there's frogs with their stomachs cut open and the hearts are beating, you know, you can eat them as well. And then she took them back to her house, and she was just a natural at being able to show people how to cook well. And she was so vivacious and fun, and people loved it. Within 6 months, her cooking school became the number one thing to do on TripAdvisor. Wow. Number two was Grand Palace. It was just an authentic Thai experience that people couldn't get anywhere else. So it was about the food, but it was about the great stories that were coming out from this community and the experiences that people had. Ange then got her to do a cookbook. And we had a friend from Australia who's an award-winning photographer. She took all the food, but also the stories and the location, the people and the place. It was amazing. They called it Cooking with Poo. That one put it in the Frankfurt Book Fair, you know, the biggest book fair in the world. And it won an award for the oddest book title of the year.
Brilliant.
And comedians all around the world picked it up. Jonathan Ross in this country did. Jamie Oliver, you know, the celebrity chef. He did a whole episode on his FoodTube channel. And if you look up FoodTube and Jamie Oliver and Cooking with Poo, you'll see Jamie wearing an apron that said, "I cooked with poo and I love
it." Brilliant.
So it was a transformative kind of thing. Now, when I had one of my books was my PhD thesis on the rise of urban slums and what's a Christian response to it. You need all the help you can get to sell a book. And so I brought my celebrity chef friend along to the Foreign Correspondents Press Club. And the press were there. It was an amazing night to launch the book, and Poo and all the neighborhood kind of came, and the international press were there. But the first question went to Poo. And it was a very good question, actually. It was, "Poo, you're so successful at what you're doing, you know, your cookbook, your cooking school. Why do you stay in Klong Toi, the most notorious slum in Bangkok, if you don't need to? You've got boys. You know, why do you stay?" It was actually a very insightful question. In church growth literature, they talk about redemption and lift. You know, people come to faith and have connections and get rid of, you know, expensive personal sin. There's an uplift that can kind of happen and people move out. Redemption and lift sounds like a new kind of wonder bra to me. But Poo had to stay. And I think that it's one thing people like ourselves relocating into a place intentionally. It's another thing people who could leave deciding to stay. And Poo did that. And she said, "Well, I'm not as wealthy as you might think. We've set up a foundation to help young people get employed. So we employ lots of young people. And when they're ready, we help them start their own enterprise." We started lots of enterprises over the time. And actually, if you go to Klong Toi today, Poo's cooking school is still going, you know, 20 years later. It's been through all that. They had fires, they've had floods, they've had COVID, all those things. And she just keeps bouncing back. And it is remarkable. But that bit of Klong Toi looks different. Like to the rest of the slum community, and you could see that kind of approach of working with what's strong to fix what's wrong was possible. And so we love the challenge of it. We love the vitality of it. The language was difficult. The conditions were hard. And for me personally, it really did nearly kill me. I had dengue fever, and I could feel the life going out of me, and I thought it was the end. Ange had dengue fever, and she kept riding a motorbike everywhere. So we're made of different things. So we loved it. And we could see the possibilities all around the world for this kind of, strength-based approach.
Wow. I know you make light of it, but actually, I think the 12 years you've been there, you've suffered real, real hardship. The fact that you came over to England, to Birmingham, thinking that it was all sorted, you made an amazing decision to give up everything you set up in the first place, which is phenomenal in itself. To come over to the UK to start something again, hoping that it was all going to work, completely backfired. 20 years on, you've got Seedlands. So tell me more about that, please, how that started after all your success and failures beforehand.
Yeah, so it's Seedbeds.
Sorry, why did I call it Seedlands?
And it's 10 years we've been going here.
Apart from that, and minor incidentals, I'm doing so well. I'll ask the question again. No, let's keep it in. Let's be radical. Go for it. You understand the question, go for it.
I do understand the question. I think part of what I wanted to do in the second half of my life was invest in the next generation of local community leaders. I really felt like that if you're in a middle-class kind of neighbourhood, there's lots of options for you, for training, for resourcing, to fulfil your potential. But the real places that need that most are inner city, outer estates, those communities that have been left behind. And so Seedbeds is really about that, developing processes that help discover, connect and release the local potential of people and places. And that the word Seedbeds came from John Perkins, who listeners may know from America. He was a civil rights leader. He started the Christian Community Development Association. I talked about myself being a relocator and Pooh being a remainer, remaining there. He was a returner, and he actually came up with those three terms. He grew up in Mississippi. His mother died essentially from starvation. His brother was killed by police, and they sent him across to LA to be with relatives. He grew up there, got married, started a business, and then felt to return to Mississippi in the 1970s, in the middle of all the civil rights riots and all the problems. I mean, that takes incredible courage to return. You know what it's like, and to keep doing it. We were a bit naive, really. We didn't really know what it was going to be like. In 2014, we had a big summit in Kuala Lumpur, and I was trying to describe this intention to invest in the next generation of local community leaders. We wanted somewhere that would be a live kind of exhibit of what was possible. We wanted to find out ourselves how far can this approach go, and seeing change happen. Really felt like Winston Green could be it. And I just kind of rambled in front of, he said, why Birmingham, you know? And I kind of rambled for about 5 minutes. I was in front of my peers and a living legend, and was a bit embarrassed, if I'm honest, trying to describe what I wanted to see happen. And he said, I know what you're trying to do. You want to grow seedbeds. People will come and learn and grow, and some of them may be replanted in other places, but you'll help them. You'll help them grow that they wouldn't normally grow. You'll provide the nutrients and the water and the nurture, and people will grow, and some will stay, but others will be replanted, and the ecosystem you develop will change the world. And it felt like a bit of a prophecy at the time. And it was kind of all those dark things that were kind of happening, nothing working out. I had in my mind, now Winston Green can be a seedbed. This is what I want to work towards. I didn't really know in lots of ways how that would work out. We started working with Nazarene Theological College for master's programs. We started piloting the Changemakers program, which is a local leadership kind of incubator program. They incubate their idea for change in their community. They get nominated by the local community, and then they pitch their idea at the end, like a dragon's den at the end. And so we're doing that also now with Pioneers, with the United Reformed Church. And then we've been working in Ukraine and Myanmar and other Australia now as well. So it has become a kind of a going all around the world. But it started here in Winston Green, and this vision to invest in local leaders, find their talents, connect them, release them, that is what's been happening. And so it is a joy. And Winston Green itself has changed. I mean, one of the things that we started off in New Biggin House. We helped campaign for the saving of a local park and then the rezoning of land for a school. So we started £26 million new high school state-of-the-art facility on an old wasteland that was derelict land. And that's a brand new high school that started last year. And it's an amazing school.
Yeah.
And then housing is the other thing we've been campaigning for. And then we took over an old URC church here that was derelict, had five people left in it. And we were getting 500 people a week through New Biggin House. So he said, look, could we start a morning service here? Could we take over the building responsibility for it? You keep meeting at 4 p.m. as long as you like. But once these buildings like this go, the community never get them back again.
Yeah.
We really want to open it back up to the community. And so that was 4 years ago we took over this place, and we have literally hundreds of people coming in a day. You're in the library part of this. This was all almost underwater when we first took it over. We've got social enterprise bike, social enterprise advocacy, community cafe, the chapel has all kinds of things happening on it, office space. We've just taken over. The last bit that we didn't have was upstairs, a massive big hall. They used to have a gym and boxing and dancing and all kinds of stuff, but the ceiling literally was falling down, so we weren't allowed it in there. We've done all ourselves, really. We've had a couple of supporters who gave one particular family, the family trust gave $50,000, and basically we've been able to do the whole lot.
Wow.
The denomination did some surveys and stuff, and when we were here, they said, oh, look, it's $1.5 million you've got to raise to fix this building up. You'll never do it. This is a waste of money trying to put money into it. But we really felt as a local community we could come together. Their latest survey said that, yeah, it's about £500,000 worth of repairs left. So between ourselves, we've done over £1 million of repairs. Then that's local people, local skilled kind of tradesmen helping us out. And so we've still got a way to go. Actually, next month, the whole floor will be done. And so that every bit of the space will be safe and usable and accessible. So, yeah, so those kind of things, using with what's here, not just individual people's talents, but also the place's gifts and strengths need to be released. And so we're seeing that happen all over the UK, in East London and East Birmingham and in Glasgow. So we've got alumni who are in Africa and all kinds of places now. And so that dream that Dr. Perkins kind of talked about, well, it has become a kind of prophecy for us, and it's coming true.
Well, talking of prophecy, I'm going to use that to dig myself out when I said seedlands instead of seed beds. Maybe your next project will be called Seedlands.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, we'll take our country, you think.
I want to home in, though, please, because you're an incredibly, I can use the word correctly, positive guy here. And it sounds really exciting what you've done. But I think we need to put the other side of the coin in focus here as to the mental state you must have gone through, what the family went through, because you had to start again from the beginning. And I'd like to major on that, not for any other reason other than just to encourage those who are going through it at the moment. So please share all.
Yeah, I think having that in the back of your mind, what you need to be faithful to is really important. They talk about resilience and grit being passion and for a purpose over time. And I think that quality of grit is something that, you've got to be willing to go through those ordeals to see the new deal happen. Nothing is ever given to you on a plate, and or at least nothing's ever been given to me. Maybe some people do, but I never experienced that. And even in Klong Toi, it's the weaknesses that you have together. That's what binds us together. So it's not just our vision. Even this place here, I mean, had someone given us $1.5 million to fix the building up, it would not have the ownership and the connection that we have today, because everyone feels like they've contributed. Yeah, so I think there is part of that becoming weak enables us to, it shapes us, it bonds us to people. I think you can't do it by yourself. I think one of the blessednesses that I've had is being part of the community of Aidan and Hilda. It's one of the things I knew when I first came. I couldn't do it by myself. I'd been part of a community, but the community of Aidan and Hilda, a dispersed community. I had a soul friend, Jeff Holt is a guy here in Birmingham who is part of the community. And so we'd meet each month. And sometimes it was just me crying and him putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, Ash, God loves you and he's not let you go. You're here for a purpose. And just a little bit of encouragement and that really helped me. And finding those things I think that we can do. And I am a person who needs to get up early and prepare for my day. So I am like a 6 a.m. kind of guy who gets up and needs silence and solitude and prayer so I'm receptive for the day. And I really needed it during that time. I feel like I need it now in different ways, partly because there's so many things I could be doing. And so I need the focus and attention to make sure I'm working on the right things at the right time and don't kind of just spin my wheels. And sometimes that's hard to know. But I think that detecting that passion in our lives and the purpose for what it's for and focusing that and that resilience, that willingness to bounce back is part of the story. It's part of the journey. And I don't know anyone who's been in this kind of work that doesn't experience heartbreak, that doesn't experience some kind of form of injustice or unfairness that happens. Yeah, so I do try to stay positive, and I do those gratitude kind of things of three things I'm grateful for this morning that happened yesterday. I like to have done lists as well as to-do lists, that these are things that have been done. I never want to take these things for granted. My Camino that I'm going for on Sunday is a gratitude Camino. I'm thanking the Lord for the year I've had. And I've always tried to find those things that are there and nurture those and savor those good things in my life. Even at my darkest moments, there's always something to be grateful for.
Yeah.
Even if lots of other things are not going well. So I'm not sure if that all helps, but
it does. I'm just going to do a quick advert on my behalf, if that's right. A previous episode, maybe a year ago, with Father Brendan McManus, he organises tours and has done several books on the Camino, explaining what it's like walking on it as well. So if you go back to, I don't know, about episode 50, something like that, you'll find a whole episode about what a Camino is about and what this Camino de Santiago is all about and who actually set it all up as well. It's a very informative podcast.
Wow, I'll go back and hear that.
There you go. I'm glad I told you. But if I had loads and loads of money and I was able to say, well, thank you for your answer, but we're now going live via satellite to your wife on the border and ask her the same question, what was it like? And we could also then bring your daughter in, who stays in Australia at the moment, ask her.
Also got a son as well. So he's 21. He was born in Bangkok and came out here when he was 11. So,
oh, wow. So I've got three link-ups here to do then. Where's your son at the moment?
He's in London at the moment. He's wanting to be a filmmaker.
Oh, wonderful.
Film was in the Birmingham Film Festival, nominated for Best New Filmmaker. And so wow. He's trying to make a go of filmmaking.
Well, that's three link-ups I've got to do. If I could bring them all together via my satellite technology,
yes,
and ask them the question I asked you, what would they say, do you think?
If you had have asked Amy this question 10 years ago, she would have said, oh, I can't believe what my parents did to me. Although I found a magazine article just here the other day. It was like one of those kind of women's articles, and it was Amy, she was 17. She just moved back to Melbourne. She hadn't been coping and really wanted to finish her schooling in Melbourne and didn't want to be responsible for us leaving Bangkok as well. It was a really complex time. And then she got interviewed by this women magazine. And, you know, I grew up in a slum, rat-infested slum with prostitutes as friends and all that kind of stuff. But it was beautiful. And she ended up saying, you know, right at the end, you know, I need to find out what my contribution in the world is going to be. She's now working with Burmese refugees in Australia. She's with Foundation House. So the victims and survivors of torture that she's working with, and she's really found her voice. Ames had some real dark times in Bangkok. Angie had some really dark times here. Those first few years really were difficult. And if you pushed her, probably she would say, yeah, she was really mad at me for bringing them all the way out here. Even at this worst point, I still love being here. Even at its best points, Ange hasn't always loved being here. So it has been a real challenge on how to manage each other's callings and give each other space to do things. And she's on a sabbatical at the moment on the Thai Burma border. So, and that's part of how we kind of support each other. You know, Aidan would need to speak for himself, but he kind of went through a stage where he loved every minute of it. He loved being in a big village where everyone knew him and loved him and cared for him. Coming to the UK was quite a shock to the system. The education system was difficult. He wasn't the centre of life like he was. And he found it challenging. He's found his passion in filmmaking during COVID, actually. He did some courses with BFI, I think it's called.
British Film Institute.
Yeah, and loved it. Absolutely kind of found his passion. And because he has such a different view of the world, he has a unique kind of take on things. He was probably not aware of how difficult things were. Is consciously aware of how difficult it was. But what we really felt with our kids is that we wanted them to be aware as they could cope with what was going on. And so our debriefings and all those kind of things were a challenge. Because we want to keep them safe and they have been. But we also wanted them to be aware. And I think part of our hope for them was that they would find their passions, be able to fulfill their potential. So I think all of them would say there were different seasons that were more challenging, and some of those were different times. But I think all of them today, if you brought them back today, would say, wow, we've got to really live a life, you know, we've got to see some things.
I don't know if it would be fair for me to use the word railroaded, but the fact that you felt convinced you had to move to Birmingham from Thailand, and of course, growing up yourself in Australia, and Ange having sort of similar feelings about Thailand as well, and your two kids. How would you explain it to others, saying that if you really feel God's calling you to do it, to go for it and try not to railroad people in at the same time, i.e. your loved one, your family?
Yeah, it's a really good one. I felt like we needed some discernment about what we were going to do, and I had to hold the UK dream lightly to allow other people to, including Ange, to be able to come if she was up for it. We knew we couldn't stay in Bangkok, and so there was a question then about, okay, where are we going to go? But initially, Ange was really resistant about leaving Bangkok, and it just got so desperate that we felt like we needed to. And Ange came to that conclusion. I think the other thing that happens sometimes, if you get an intuition, like the one I did about being on the train here in Birmingham and going, wow, if I had another life, this is where I'd like to be. I did share that with Ange at the time, and Ange kind of freaked out a bit, you know, oh, I'll never go to England. I'll go anywhere but England. But it would be so cold and dark and, you know, miserable. You know? And I, of course, love. Today is one of my favourite times of the year where it's blue sky, it's crisp and cold. I come alive here. And so, I don't think we railroaded Ange. I realised it was a huge sacrifice for Ange to come to the UK in ways it wasn't for me. In ways for me, it was a fulfillment of a dream and a hope and a prophecy. For Ange, it was letting go of her being fully alive and fully in her own skin. And so it was a massive sacrifice for her. So her being in Thailand at the moment for 4 months, it'll be, I'm going out there for Christmas with her, is part of, you know, helping Ange to fulfill her dreams as well. But I think we try to do that for each other. And at different times, there were different seasons where either one of us have had the main thing being for them. But I think I go back to that initial kind of Tony Campolo thing of that surrendering all and giving all to God and being open to that. Had either one of us at any point said, no, I'm not going to do that, it would make our lives really difficult. And but because we're off that same value base, we can negotiate the details.
I'm sure people in the past have said, well, we didn't move because the kids didn't want to move. What would you have done had they put the foot down and said, we're not going?
Yeah, I mean, there was a real chance with Aidan that he really wanted to stay in Thailand. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you know, your kids didn't have a choice in what you do and all that. But no kids have choices what their parents do. That's not how it works. What I hope my kids have is that if they've got a dream, that they're willing to go for it and they've experienced what's possible. I don't know the answer. Had the kids really put their foot down and said, we're not going, or I think it would have been very difficult to stay in Bangkok. Melbourne to Bangkok was slightly different because Amy was 5 and it was all a big adventure for us. We were in our early 30s. That felt different. Birmingham felt different. For me, it was kind of a return to my ancestral home, if you like, and what I felt I was destined to do. But it was much tougher for Aidan and for Ange.
But at the end of the day, you have to pray about it and not railroad, but explain it in such a way whereby eventually people come on board. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, that's fair. Although you've got to be prepared to say no, actually, as well, because you don't want to go and I won't do it. And Ange said, if there's no way I can do this, then I would have to respect that. And so, I don't think you can railroad people into things. It has to be discerned. You know, if I hadn't come to Birmingham, could God still have used me somewhere else? I'm sure he could have.
Well, in the remaining time before we get to the final question as to who your Christian hero is, I've just got a feeling it might be one of two people that you've mentioned already. We have mentioned Myanmar. Mm. Some people will still call it by its old name. I think it was Burma, if I remember rightly.
That's right.
How come you got so involved in Myanmar in the remaining time and what you've been doing there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the refugee groups in Melbourne that we got to know was the Burmese community, and it was called Burma in those days. People may know there was a military dictatorship, there was a massacre, and lots of Burmese came to Australia. So we got to know many of them, and some of them were actually high-level leaders within Burma. They were democratic activists, they were working for the National League for Democracy, who won the election, but were never able to govern properly because of the military. And talk about the 88 generation, there was a massacre, and this generation of leaders, many of them went all around the world, including Australia. So we got to know, literally, a guy called Joe Somu was moving in over the back fence of ours in Springvale. I got to know Joe. Turns out he was one of the most wanted people in Burma for his democracy work. And Joe kind of took us on the journey. He was only young then, really. He was quite tiny in comparison to me, at least. But he came to live with us. We helped English. We helped him get a degree as a social worker. He's still in Melbourne. So we've kind of had an interest. Then when we lived in Thailand, there was a lot of Burmese coming over the border. The military rarely have been in control for, you know, 60 years, 70 years. And so it's heartbreaking how Burmese people have been treated by their own military. It's disgusting. The world has just allowed it to happen. There's been no international interventions in the same way in other places like Kosovo or Kuwait, all these kind of places. And so our hearts always bled for Burma for over 30 years. The National League for Democracy, our friends, won the election in October 2020. We thought a new day was finally going to come, that they would have full democratic control. When they started, the day they were supposed to be sworn in February 2021, the military came through and did a coup d'etat and have been massacring their people ever since. And so Joe Somu and others who we knew really well said, look, I know you're doing change makers. We just need something for the folks who are resisting the military. They're civil servants, they're teachers, they're doctors, they're policemen. They can't work for the government. Now they're part of the civil disobedience movement. Could you do some of your change makers programs that Joe had been kind of following? And I said, oh, that would be great, Joe. You know, how many people are you talking? He said, well, it's 350,000, the civil disobedience movement. You know, could you train them? And I said, well, Joe, we normally do 12 or 13. I'm not sure if we could do that really, but I'm sure we could find a way. And so we started an incubator program. What they really needed was an income to generate income themselves. And so we helped them incubate their businesses initially online, and then they'd pitch their idea. We'd go in person. We're doing that for 3 years. But we've had over 200 participants in that program. We're working mainly with what's called the National Unity Government. They're the elected government, and particularly the Ministry of Labor. Ange is literally kind of staying with them. And there are partners on the ground there. So they're starting and strengthening enterprises that help people get income. But they're also working with clinics and schools and all kinds of education and health projects as well. So Ange is there. Particularly, I kind of do the training side, and Ange is helping these fledgling enterprises get going. That will probably do a Seedbeds marketplace kind of website so people can buy the products, and all the proceeds will go back to people. And some of them, restaurants and farms and all kinds of schools and clinics, as I say. And so, yeah, so Ange is trying to help it be sustainable for the longer term. We're probably not going to get a third intake next year in the Change Incubator program. We just haven't got the resources. But we're probably going to work with those 200 or so and then have another intake the year after. We're trying to connect in with different universities to be able to offer online programs as well. Ange actually just had a really bad motorbike accident yesterday. She hit another motorbike, and luckily she's wearing a helmet, but we think she's broken her shoulder or collarbone, whatever. She's struggling today. But we're hopeful these connections will set up a Seedbeds Myanmar or Seedbeds Thailand, and we can continue to support in more intentional kind of ways. We've been training the trainers and all that kind of stuff so that local people can run things themselves, and that's part of what Ange is doing as well.
Very quickly then, if I went over to Myanmar today,
yeah,
and you came with me,
yeah,
how bad or how unsafe would it be for us walking through the main streets of Myanmar?
Firstly, I'm a banned person, so we'd have to sneak over, and we do that by going over rivers. It's quite a porous kind of boundary, but it would be depends where we go, and we would probably need to go with the Civil Defence Force, which is the democratic movement, and we would need to be protected by guns and whatever else. That wouldn't necessarily protect us because the military have Russian aeroplanes that they're bombing whole villages with. The democratic forces are winning lots of the land back. They probably have about 60% of the land is now in the hands of the democratic forces. And this is without any kind of international support. They're literally making their own guns and confiscating the ones from the people they capture from the military. So no, it would be very dangerous, and I wouldn't recommend it. But in saying that, we're hoping to do a documentary next year, going inside and documenting some of this stuff in person. So you're welcome to join us.
Can I say I'll pray about it? Well, I've looked at the time, unfortunately, young Ash, and all I can say is thank you for what you shared so far. But in the meantime, Dr. Ash Barker, who is your Christian hero, please?
I mean, we're going to do Tony Campolo another time, so I'll leave Tony behind for this moment, but he would certainly be there. Let me talk about Leslie Newbegin.
I thought you'd go for him. Please share all, please.
So he used to live here in Winston Green. So he is that kind of legendary kind of person here. You want to, when you talk about placemaking, you want to work with what's here, and he's here. I first read his work, though, when I was in Australia. He had been a missionary in India, working in really tough conditions in India. He comes back at the end of his career to the UK and just feels like people have lost confidence in the gospel. They've kind of been pushed and shoved and moved around. And this is an arrogance. This is just a confidence that we need to return to, and that we can see the culture and what's going on around, yeah, in real ways, and take the culture seriously, just as we do if we're in Thailand. You know, we need to learn the language and culture and worldviews and share the love of Jesus from within communities, from within cultures, rather than it being something from another time and place. My favourite Leslie Newbegin quote is that the role of the local church is to be a sign, a foretaste, and an instrument of God's coming reign in a place for which it is responsible. And that quote has really shaped the way I see church. Church isn't just about how do we get people on a Sunday for an hour or so. The church is the people of God in a place. It has a sense of responsibility for it. It's wanting to see all the good things, the shalom of God flow. And it helps to start that, helps to demonstrate that. Another kind of famous quote from Newbegin is that the church is the hermeneutic of the gospel. That is, it's the people of God that help us understand what the good news is all about. And so I'm a real believer in local community, local-led churches that feel a sense of responsibility for their places. Anything that bad happens here, my church is responsible for that. We need to respond. We need to be part of the answer and be part of the good news. So, yeah, so Leslie Newbegin would be my hero.
You already mentioned he had a son called John, I think you said.
John Newbegin, yes.
What else do we know about him and his family?
John is he's a really creative person. I think it's Creative England, the world helping English creatives get opportunities. The family have been really supportive of us. In fact, they gave the proceeds of his books, the royalties of his books, to help us buy a minibus for the local community.
Wow.
They've been very, very generous and really supportive of us. They're great. I think, yeah, different times have struggled with the notoriety of Leslie, and because some people are kind of real devotees of Leslie, and sometimes that's been difficult for them. Obviously, in America and Australia, Leslie Newbegin's name in some ways is better known than even some places here. And so, yeah, so I think the family's kind of struggled with what the legacy of Leslie looks like. But they love coming to Winston Green and love seeing Newbegin Community Trust with all these hundreds of people engaged every day. And they love seeing that local church that has been reopened and is engaging and really feels like the Leslie spirit, as it were, is alive and well here.
It's been an amazing time, Ash. Dr. Ash Barker, it's been a phenomenal podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Bless you. And thank you for all you're doing to encourage so many of us. Bless you, mate.
Next time on Off Grid Christianity.
And I had a big red flag on my head that said, I'm really vulnerable. Why don't you bully me and coerce me? And when I go into high schools now, I always tell them the same stuff. I'm really honest. I talk about my own mental health. I talk about how dreadful school was for me and what happened. And I say that back then, coercive control hadn't been invented. But that's what happened to me. I was being coercively controlled by somebody very successfully. And that blighted my life. It really did. And my parents just didn't understand. Everything was my fault. So I couldn't say that, I couldn't tell them the truth because I only had this one friend. Everyone else thought I was a weirdo because I was. You know, I didn't know anything about popular culture. I didn't dress right. My hair was wrong. Everything was wrong about me. So that was not good at all. I ran away from home at 18, went off and started again in Exeter. And I hadn't realised that you can run away from stuff, but it stays with you, comes with you.
So please join me and very special guest, author Ruth Lee. Until then, cheerio.